The NBA Today podcast is presented by Axe. Wake up and stay alert with new Axe Rise, one of four shower gels designed to fix you up. Baseline.
To baseline.
Very good execution of a two-on-one fast break.
Coast.
To coast.
Takes it all the way down the lane.
This.
Two-hand jam.
This is the NBA Today.
The NBA Today.
What's going on? NBA Today at ESPNRadio.com. Thanks for downloading from our pod center on ESPNRadio.com or from the iTunes menu. I'm Ryan Russillo. It is a Hall of Fame edition of the podcast today. We're going to start with Hubie Brown, legendary coach, part of our announcing teams here at ESPN and ABC, and also the Iceman's here, George Gervin. So today's actually sick. I'm embarrassed they even asked me to do this today. Now, before we do that, hey, let's on Friday, we'll do our Fix a Franchise for the Pacific. We'll get that out of the way and tell you who the best planners or, you know, whatever listener had the best plan going forward, and we'll do that. We're also on Friday going to have Larry Kuhn, who is the NBA salary cap guru. It is the source. He's the source. His piece online, if you type in frequently asked questions, NBA salary cap, his thing's going to come up. I print it out at every change, and I go through it, and we're going to talk to him because he's done a couple pieces for us. So he's actually going to dispel a couple of things that are generally thought as fact, a couple of things that I've probably believed a little bit too much. And now after talking with him and reading some of the stuff, he's getting me to change my mind perhaps on a few things. So that's going to be a lot of fun. But first, we started off on Wednesdays, as always, with Tales from the Couch.
The couch.
I will retire now to my couch, a perpetual indulgence.
Handful of games last night that I wanted to get to, and I would start with Cleveland and Toronto, because I really wanted to focus in on Bosch. I'm like, you know, I want to watch him, just watch him the whole game, see where his mentality's at right now, what's his attitude with this team. And then he got an elbow in the face, 9 minutes to go in the first quarter, so basically minutes into the game. Anton Jameson hit him in the face, fractured his nasal cavity, and he was down and out. CAT scan, spent the night in the hospital. So guess what I wasn't able to do? Watch a ton of Chris Bosh. But what I did notice was the Cavs not really trying and yet still being in control of this game. They won 113-101. And I'm not going to spend a ton of time on all the games just because of the guests that we have today and the fact that I want to talk a lot about Utah and Oklahoma City, because that was awesome. But you can just tell that Toronto's not that into it, but the scary thing is Cleveland's not that into it. And Mike Brown, their head coach, said about the remaining regular season games, we are going to treat them like high-level scrimmages, high-level practices. And that's exactly how it felt. Like, the beginning of the game, you're like, there's not a ton of energy and intensity in this one. But it was all about passing for Cleveland because they were just having fun. I know that sounds silly, but that's how they played this game. Like, a guy would drive baseline as if he was going to go up for a layup, and then he would just try to pass it to somebody else. In the third quarter, Cleveland on 15 field goal makes had 15 assists. LeBron had 13 assists with a ton of time to go, and you could see him trying to pass it to other guys because 15 assists, I believe, is his career high. Mo Williams had 12. Cleveland ended this game with 56% shooting, 40% from three, took only 14 free throws, but 38 assists in this one. 20 for Jameson, very aggressive early. He's so good moving away from the basketball. LeBron, 19. His shooting numbers, he's struggling a bit. 5 of 27 on his threes over the last few games. He apparently was working pregame on just threes the whole time. That's what the announcer said. He actually posted up Sonny Weems in an interesting spot there. But this game overall, not that impressive because I don't think either team was really trying all that hard. Z, by the way, he's back, as we've known. He's played over the last five games about 23 minutes per. He's averaging 6 points per game and six boards. So strictly just a bench piece, which is exactly what we expected him to be. The minute dispersal, Jod Williams had a ton last night, 28 minutes. Varejao right around his 28 on the other side for Toronto. 23 points for Jarrett Jack, who put up some shots. Turkoglu, another bad night, 3 of 10 for only 10 points. Look at his last five. He's at 26 minutes a game and 9 points. 4 assists, 3 rebounds. Like I said, I don't want to spend a ton of time on all these other games because Pistons, Sixers, what am I going to tell you that you haven't figured out at this point 70-plus games in? Both teams aren't that great. Pistons win at 124-103. The Bobcats put up a huge first quarter against the Hawks, 34-14, and they hang on to win 109-100. Atlanta, though, didn't have Joe Johnson playing in this game. Mike Bibby didn't play in this game either. Jeff Teague had 22 minutes, but his shooting really struggled. I'll tell you this about Atlanta. I was talking with somebody with the league, and we were kind of going through the East. And by the way, Atlanta believes, and Joe Johnson was out because of a thumb injury, so that's two games in a row that he missed. But somebody that I was talking to, a guy who works in the front office, feels like Atlanta could be in a great spot if they retain Joe Johnson and say LeBron were to go somewhere else. Boston's old, Orlando doesn't have much flexibility, and Cleveland isn't going to be a very good team if LeBron's not there. That's just how good he is. I mean, would Cleveland win 40 games without him? I don't think they would. Maybe 42, maybe that's their max. But you get the point that Atlanta, if they retain Joe Johnson, is going to be a team that has a really good chance to have a run at it for a few years. Now, are they going to keep Joe? My guess is yes. Atlanta's going to max him out. They're going to offer him whatever he wants. They're going to try to keep him. So Joe Johnson's going to have to take less money and go to New York. And the other feeling, based on what the source told me, was that Joe Johnson won't be the guy that goes to New York first. So if the Knicks strike out on LeBron, Wade stays in Miami, maybe Amari goes to Miami with Wade, Boozer gets re-signed with Utah, which we'll touch on a little bit later, and Bosch decides he wants to leave Toronto, so then he goes to New York, then maybe Joe Johnson goes with him. But if you think Joe Johnson's just going to show up by himself and be the face of the franchise for the Knicks after all this buildup, I just don't know that he's that guy. He's a pretty quiet guy, although he did say when he was leaving Phoenix, I'm going to go to whoever is going to pay me the most money, and who can pay him the most money, still the Atlanta Hawks. Another source that I was talking to when we were kind of going through these East teams were like, Atlanta can be really good, but their lack of a defined leader, and because Al Horford's still young and can't really get in a ton of guys' faces, they still are capable of really bad losses. I'm not going to chalk last night's game up as a bad loss. They hung with Cleveland going back to last week where they lost there by only 5 points. They beat the Lakers and they looked impressive. They took care of the Pacers looking at their last five games. But there's a concern a little bit with this Hawks team that, you know, they are capable of a bad loss, but they're not going to be playing against bad teams in the playoffs, most likely. So maybe they'll be a little bit more focused. Wizards destroy the Warriors 112-94. It sounds like that's not that one-sided, but it was actually worse as I was watching this game for clips. Golden State played seven guys again. You know, it's just every night you watch him and you're like, man, I can't believe they ever win any games. Steph Curry, 27 points. I know they beat the Knicks. They won at Toronto after Boss missed that layup on Sunday. They have a Clippers win in there, but they got Minnesota tonight. It's just, we can't get too carried away about them at all. Nick Young had a really nice game. He had 29 points, 10 of 18 shooting, 5 of 11 from 3. The dude can shoot, and I don't know where he's going to be as far as his career in this league, but he's going to play for a while. And if he was ever with a good team, it could kind of come off the bench and just be asked to knock down some shots, and he can get his own shot a little bit with a few dribbles. He can be a nice player in this league out of USC, but if you're asking him to be like your second guy or third guy, I don't know that he's ever going to be that player. The Rockets take care of the Grizzlies, 113-103. How about this matchup? Kevin Martin, 39 minutes, 7-16 shooting, 12 free throws, hits them all, goes for 29 points. OJ Mayo, these two guys going at it, he scores 4 points. The Beat plays 14 minutes last night, as you know. Gasol with that partially torn neck muscle, out for the season based on the reports going back to the beginning of the month. The Beat really struggled defensively a little bit. Scola did a good job of a running hook on him, 17 points. Scola just puts up numbers, man. He also sets moving picks every single time. Aaron Brooks, 17 in this one. Not a great night of shooting. But Brooks, I think it's clearly been established, he's not going to be the best player on a really great team, but he's going to be somebody that plays in the league a long time because of his combo guard skills that actually work, as opposed to, for most guys, working against them. Spurs take care of the Kings, 95-86. That was the late game last night. Manu Ginobili, only 16 points, which is a shock because he basically has been a one-man wrecking crew over the last few. 18 against Houston, 43 against Orlando, and 32 against the Lakers. What a weekend to put up 43 against the Magic and 32 against the Lakers. The rest of the squad, Duncan, 29 minutes, only 10 points. Didn't need him as much. You're going to see his numbers drop off a bit just because they're going to rest him, even though they're probably fighting to stay in the 7 spot as opposed to the 8 spot. But I don't know, who would you rather play, the Jazz or the Lakers right now? or doubt. You know, like it's a valid question. Tony Parker did come back and play in this one after missing a ton of games, 8 points in 17 minutes. So Parker ready to go, and that's a good sign for this team. On the other side, Tyreke Evans, 43 minutes, 22 points, leading all scorers. And he took 24 shots in this one, 6 assists, and just another big stat night for Tyreke. But let's get to the main event. The main event is not Boston, New York, so don't worry. By the way, Gallinari, a career-high 31 points for the Knicks, hit a 2 that was actually originally ruled a 3. That was a big shot for them. The Celtics fell apart in the end after coming all the way back. They looked lifeless. Rondo did a terrible job on an inbounds with about 7 seconds to go, held on to the ball, dribbled, couldn't get it to Ray, and then passed it to Rashid, and by the time Rashid caught it, the clock had expired. That's inexcusable. You can't have that happen. Bucks beat the Bulls 79-74. That was as bad a game for Chicago as you're going to see a while. The scoring was terrible. Nobody got any points. Luol Deng led all scorers with 16. They only took 74 shots in this game. And that's against a Bucks team that usually likes to actually push the momentum a little bit. The main event was Oklahoma City at Utah. This game was awesome. I watched it start to finish, overtime win for your Jazz, and we're talking about career nights, 140-139, and it was very clear from the beginning that both teams wanted to push the tempo. The starting matchups went like this. Deron Williams against Russell Westbrook, although Thabo Sefolosha had him late and overtime was trying to check him. Sefolosha against Wesley Matthews. Matthews about 6'5", 220. C.J. Miles is slightly bigger at 6'6", 227. He was on Kevin Durant. Jeff Green against Boozer and Nenad Krstić against Memo Okor. Now, we spoke with Doc Rivers last week on the podcast, and he said if he were redrafting the league, I asked about Durant, and he threw out Deron Williams in there. He's like, LeBron, he goes, Kobe because of age, I'm not quite sure. And he's like, Durant, there's not too many guys ahead of him, maybe Howard because of the size. And then I found it interesting that he said Deron Williams. Now, I've said for a while that I think Chris Paul is the best point guard, but if we're looking at him versus Deron Williams, it's 1 and 2 now. There's not a big gap, so I don't think it's any shame in saying that you're the number 2 guy, but some people in the league may think you're the number 1 guy. Williams scored a career-high 42 points last night, including the game winner. But let's run you through some of the game as I saw it. Now, those are your starting matchups. Jazz get up 18-10. Deron Williams is pushing the issue constantly. Memo Okor had a good start. Remember, Andre Kirilenko has now missed 11 of 12 with that calf injury. By the way, Kyle Korver, you want to just throw this one out there real quick? He didn't do anything last night. Didn't actually score in 17 minutes. But on the season, he's hitting 55% of his threes. 55 for 100, but he's only taking about 2 a game. When the benches came in, Oklahoma City basically subbed in 4 for 4 right about the same time. Harden in, Maynard in at point, Serge Ibaka in, Nick Collison, and they leave them with Durant. Bench on the other side. Deron Williams actually had 2 fouls early in this one. Ronnie Price, Kyle Korver, Paul Millsap. Both teams like to go small in this one, as we'll mention a little bit later on. Whenever Krstić, KD, or Serge are out there, even Jeff Green on some threes, like, Oklahoma City has some shooters. They're able to get back into this game without necessarily having to finish at the rim because that was left for Utah's side. They had a ton of points in the paint. Deron Williams, you're so worried about him defensively that you could see Oklahoma City on screens that involve Williams at the top of the key that they'd leave both defensive players just kind of waiting for Williams to pick a side, and that would burn Oklahoma City for a few possessions. It happened late, too, where he was able to just then pass over the top of the two defensive players as the big who set him the screen would roll to the hoop, and Boozer was definitely the beneficiary to that a few times. Boozer had a dunk off of this double at one point where he just stared at Serge, actually got hit with a technical. It was a great dunk, the kind of play of the game type of dunk. And at the end of the third quarter, you're looking at 97-94. Boozer was great, 28 points, 15 boards, 5 assists for him. He also, whenever he had Krstić on him or Nick Collison, he was really quick with his post move, very aggressive, didn't give either defender a chance to kind of set up a base and, you know, get aware of what Boozer was trying to do, which was just really, really impressive for him. It was 110-102. The Jazz were getting the loose balls. Deron Williams fell down. Actually, he tried to finish with just a poster kind of dunk. It didn't work out there. Then it's 117-104 after C.J. Miles hits a 3, and you're thinking, all right, 3 minutes to go, 5 minutes to go. It's towards the end of the game. Oklahoma City tried to hang with them throughout. It's not going to happen. And Oklahoma City, young team on the road, they're done. And then Kevin Durant took over. He hit 3 threes where it was a pull-up, one where he hung in the air at the top of the key, and then a 30-footer in rhythm where his form didn't break down at all. Just insane. Durant scored 45 last night. He went 13 to 29, 7 of 13 from 3, and he hit all 12 of his free throws. Just a monster game for him. So then Jeff Green ends up hitting a 3. That sends it to overtime. Now in overtime, as you mentioned, Cephalosha's on Deron Williams. Oklahoma City went small. They're Green, Kevin Durant, Harden, Thabo, Westbrook versus Boozer, Millsap, CJ, and Wesley with Deron Williams. So both teams actually went really small. Deron Williams had a step back 3 in the corner that was sick. Then on the other side with 5 seconds left, Jeff Green basically catches the ball after somebody else had fallen down. He hits a runner, and now Oklahoma City's up a point. You're thinking, how did Oklahoma City come back and win this game? Then Deron Williams on a great play that Utah ran where it was a handoff. Harden lost him completely. Deron Williams about 17, 18 feet away. Pull-up jumper, 1 second left. Utah holds Oklahoma City, and Durant actually was hacked bad. Hacked really bad on an attempt at the end. He was fouled. There was no question. The ball came about 10 feet short of the rim. So Durant should have gotten free throws. He was really upset after the game. But I hate to dwell on that just because it was such a great basketball game. The Jazz, had they lost, would have moved to the 5 seed. Now they move to the 2 seed. That's how close it is out west. But I think you walk away from that game being just as impressed with both teams. Utah hangs on to win, but I was very impressed with Oklahoma City as well. The Jazz, though, on some of those inbound plays, they murder guys. And I can't believe they were getting away with it last night. They basically hold you, and you can't even get a free release from them once the ball's inbounded. But if the refs aren't calling it, I'm not going to fault the Jazz for doing it. But it's something that you just get so frustrated when you're a coach, you're going to go back and watch that tape, and you're probably going to send it to the league office being like, you guys got to be kidding me. The Durant foul thing, that'll be a big deal. Like, you're going to hear something about that because he was absolutely hacked by one of the Jazz. I think it was Wesley, or it might have been CJ, that hacked him, but it was after the release, but it didn't allow Durant's form to follow through, so that's why the ball came up that short. But Utah gets the win. Deron Williams, an all-time kind of game, and Durant proving with those shots that he's impossible to defend. So let's get to our interviews today. We got two of them. We're going to start with legendary Hall of Famer Hubie Brown.
Hubie, let's start with the West, because when you look at all these matchups, I've been saying now for a while, it's hard to pick necessarily against any of these teams. I mean, I think you can make an argument to like all 8 teams. Is there one matchup that you look at that you think maybe is a little bit more one-sided than the rest of us do?
No, mainly because of the injury factor. And I think that's going to tell the tale of how we go out there, mainly because so many key guys are out. And when you think that right now the Lakers are struggling because their rotation with their second unit is poor, mainly because of Bynum being out. Now, if Bynum does not come back, or he comes back and re-injures himself, I think that any one of these teams can get a good shot, especially if they would play a team like San Antonio. And we saw what San Antonio did yesterday in L.A., plus Tony Parker's still not even back. Mm-hmm. So when you look at a Denver, you know, Martin is out. So to me, we have key teams. Now, I like Utah. I think Utah has always been a good team. They've always had trouble with Los Angeles. For whatever the matchup, they can never seem to beat L.A. in L.A. in any series every year that you think they're going to be able to do it. But they were playing on top of their game when they inserted Kirilenko into the starting lineup, but now Kirilenko is injured and he's in and out. Now, without Kirilenko, they're going to have difficulty matching up. So to me, when I look at the West, every one of the 8 teams has a good shot at winning 50 games. I've been in this league a long time. We have never had that before, at least that I can remember. 8 teams in one conference with 50 wins. Now, usually we only have, say, 5 to 7 teams on both sides combined that have won 50. So it's great for those teams, but it's also bad for the teams that are out of the playoffs, because we have so many bad teams in the Eastern Conference and a few very bad teams in the West.
Hubie, when you're a coach, what were you looking for out of your team late, those last 5 to 6 games as you get ready for the playoffs?
Well, unfortunately for me, when we came back in Memphis, we had injuries. Mm-hmm. So 4 key guys in, you know, we used to rotate 10 guys. Well, 4 key guys were injured, and they had to be out of the lineup at that time. Unfortunately for us, in the, like you said, in the last eight games, we staggered to the finish line, and we had just won 50 games. Well, unfortunately for us, we draw San Antonio in the first round. Now, we were 3-4, 3-1 with San Antonio during the season in our favor, but unfortunately, once we got into the playoffs, we could never hit that same winning stride that we had during the season. But I also underline that and say, Tony Parker and Tim Duncan are no longer playing 34 minutes. Mm-hmm. They're playing 38 to 40 minutes. And that makes a major difference when you talk about what a team did with a team during the season and what a team is going to play at playoff time. The increased minutes for your star players and then reduced minutes for the substitutes. So for us, we could never get it back. Now, all of our other teams in the other stops that we had in the playoffs, we played right to the end. We would rest our guys, and say a guy played 36 minutes for us. We would bring him in at, say, 30 to 32 in those remaining games, but we still wanted the efficiency in the first and third quarters, as well as still practicing our pressing and trapping and rotating. There's a lot that goes into all of this, but it depends upon your team, the age of your team. Also, how many guys are injured at this time? Also, do you want to take a look at a couple of guys that you feel, if you did have an injury and you move the bench guy up to the starting unit, you would like to give this guy a little more time now as you finish the season so he could be ready to step into the second unit? I never worried about an injury on the first unit. A guy who's one of your key guys in your rotation off the bench will always step up and do a great job. The problem is, who takes that guy's place? That's always the key. Who steps up and gets the major minutes on a second unit when you have to rotate your people?
QB, when we look at Oklahoma City, it's been a surprise this year. And I think more than just a surprise, it's a surprise they've been so good defensively when we look at how young they are. 9 of the 15 guys on the roster are 25 years or younger. But why is it over time just so hard for young teams to make that jump from perhaps 45 to 50 wins, that's a surprise season like the Thunder's had, to the let's make a run at this and maybe end up in the Western Conference Finals? I know some of it has to do with talent, but young teams kind of understanding how good they can be. Why is that step so much harder than maybe 30 to 50 wins in just the regular season?
Well, I think you have to start off and say that everyone has to buy into the offense and defense of the coaching staff. Then the coaching staff must be disciplined and force the players to be accountable for the goals. Now, you never eliminate what I just said. This is the key to coaching young teams. And also now, there are no leaders of the team. There are very few leaders because they're young. Mainly, the guys aren't going to respect when they talk, because they know they've never been in this type of a situation before. So the leaders have to be the coaching staff. When the coaching staff forces everything, then once the team starts winning, and then they receive the success, meaning the 50. When you get 50 wins, you've really come a long way. Now, once you hit 50 wins, you'll see the stars start to emerge. You'll see the guys who really want the ball under pressure. Now, in Oklahoma City, they're very fortunate to have this incredible talent in Durant, because not only has Durant improved in his scoring since the first year he came in the league, but he's built his body up, so now he's an excellent rebounder at that small forward position, which he was not in his first couple of years in the league. Then he's now not only a great shooter and closer, he has become one of the highlights that we have in the league on the foul line. Going into yesterday, he's shooting 89% from the line. Now, you have to understand, that is a staggering stat. because we have five guys shooting 90%. He's sixth in the league. But how about the fact that he's taken 211 more foul shots than Dirk Nowitzki? Because, you see, when you start looking at the statistics and look at the guys who are shooting 85% or better, Nowitzki, if Durant wasn't in the league, he would be the highest foul shot attempt guy in that group at 537. So I want to bring that out about Durant, because not only is he a great three-point threat off the dribble now because he gets fouled, but he's become an outstanding rebounder, and now you foul him, he's going to the line most nights, 10 to 15, 16 times a game. That is sensational. So you say, well, what's the big deal about that? In years one and two, when you have a young team, you don't get the calls in a close game. You do not get the non-call. The non-call meaning that a defensive player blocks a shot but gets you with his body. When you're young, it's a two-shot foul, even though it was a clean block, but you got the guy with your body. Once you become a defensive guy known throughout the league by players and referees, you get the non-call in that situation. And that's what I always try to tell our young teams, which we had in Atlanta and in Memphis. You know, we had really young clubs. We would tell them, you cannot cry. We have to establish a notoriety. We have to establish our physical toughness. And if we're going to press and trap and be up there at the top in shot blocks, forced turnovers, and steals, well, then we can't cry at the other end. And the only way that we can get that call or get that non-call is to win. And once you get to 50, all of a sudden now, home or away, you're getting both, the call or the non-call. And that's what I like about what's happening there in Oklahoma City. They're much better defensively now. I think that their coaching staff has made a total commitment, and I think Ron Adams has done a great job when they joined their staff about improving their defense, and now their offense and their defense are on the same page.
Hubie, whether it was you stop in the ABA with Atlanta in the 70s, Knicks early 80s, Memphis earlier this decade, what was the first thing that you tried to identify about your team and figuring out how good they could be, who the leader is? Like, what's the first thing that you're looking for as a coach taking over?
Well, whenever you take over a team, I came from the Milwaukee Bucks. I was an assistant coach of Larry Costello. They had the best record in the league 2 years in a row. They had Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Oscar Robertson. Now, Kareem was young. He had just won the MVP 3 out of 4 years. My 2 years there were totally invaluable, because what I found out is that they worked harder than any college team that I was at Duke or at William & Mary as an assistant, or any high school team that I ever coached. They worked harder than any of those teams. Now, that for me was a great lesson to understand that you can coach this way in pro basketball. The players will always accept what you have. They will accept the discipline. They will accept the practices as long as you take their talent and you take their talent to its highest potential, that you continue to teach them. And that was the mind-blowing thing, because Oscar Robertson at that time was just ending his career, which was an incredible career. Kareem was coming out of college where he was player of the year 3 years in a row, and now he's player of the year in the MVP 3 out of 4 years. They wanted to learn. And that's what you have to sell to these young guys coming in. It's about learning your business. And you get that across in the very first meeting, that we are a teaching staff, we are about accountability, and you are going to be about choice. And I said, you always have a choice. You can be on the train or off the train. But if you are off the train, you get no minutes here. Because if we had this type of teaching and discipline and organization in Milwaukee with Kareem and Oscar Robertson, there's no one in this room who is going to equal either one of their careers. So consequently, we've been with the best, and we understand what it takes to win. It's called chemistry. It's about five guys working together. So that's what you got to get across early to a young team, because they have to be taught. They have to be taught accountability at the NBA level. Then the offensive and defensive stuff will all take its course. And then what you always try to do in pro basketball is every time that we have five guys on the floor, first unit, second unit, that we have three scorers on the floor. And the offense is going to be run through those three guys. Then at the defensive end of the floor, it's defensive rebounding first. It's shooting percentages second against our defenses. And then what do we score in the open floor? We want a percentage. We want a 60 to 65% of converting in our fast break game. Now that sounds, that's not a lot. Oh yeah, well at the NBA level, if you can score 60% of your times in your transition game, you're going to be right up in the top three teams in the league. Because it's difficult against NBA transition because of the athletic quickness and shot blocking.
Hebe, when you're either watching games or doing games now at this point, do you find yourself appreciative of what you see or disappointed by what you see more often?
I think that depends. By the way, that's a very good question.
Thank you. I'm trying to get one in today. I'm trying to get one good one for you.
No, come on. All of them are good here. That's a very good one. It depends upon the talent level that you're watching. It depends upon the coach who has talent versus the other coach and what degree of talent does the other guy have. Now what you're watching for is execution, chemistry, defense, defensive rebounding, and then also the teaching in the huddles. I always watch the huddles because you can see immediately who's teaching, who's not, who stands outside the huddle until there's only a few seconds left. Then they get in the huddle and there is chaos in the huddle. Some teams, they can do that and there is total respect in the huddle and maybe one guy on the team is talking in the huddle. But then when the coaching staff steps in, you see the teaching, or you see exactly what they're going to adjust to. You always want to see adjustments from coaching staffs as the game moves on. Are you adjusting to defenses that are changing? Are you adjusting to the defenses that might have surprised you that the other team is using in this game? And then, you know, because these are the things that I'm looking for. I don't know what anyone else is looking for, but I enjoy the game when I see two well-coached teams playing one another, and at every timeout, you see something change when they come out of the huddle, whether it's a play, whether it's a changing of matchups, whether it is a defensive change. All of these things can happen once we come out of a timeout. And there are a lot of great coaches out there. There's no one way of coaching at any level, high school, college, pro. But it's interesting to watch different guys. Does the coaching match with their personalities? Do they teach differently than how they talk? And it's always eye-opening to me because I've been around pro basketball since 73, and I learn something every single night that I watch college games or pro games, and I learn something every night that I do a game. You always want to stay current. because of the athletes changing so dramatically from an athletic standpoint. Because back when I came in the 70s, the game was still played at rim level. But now we play the game 1 foot above the rim at the top of the box, which is 11 feet. And that, so you can't be just saying you're going to run the same stuff that was run in the 70s to today because of all of the incredible athleticism and shot blocking. So that's why it's always interesting to watch professional coaches working at their trade.
When I look at coaches, and I've always felt like growing up, the best ones are the ones that adapt their style to the personnel that they have. And I feel like more and more now we have coaches that have a defined style, and if you're a player, you have to figure out how to fit in, and they're not going to adapt to you anymore. And I'm going to use two examples. You can certainly agree or disagree with what I'm saying, but like when I've looked at Jim O'Brien over the years, who's now with the Pacers, he has an offense that's more open. There's freedom if you play defense. And that worked in Boston. It hasn't worked with Indiana. It didn't work in Philadelphia. When I look at Kurt Rambis trying to run a variation of the triangle, I've had basketball people that I trust tell me the triangle doesn't work with pick and roll guards, which is what Johnny Flynn would be or a John Wall would be out of Kentucky, and that it's never going to work. And my argument is, well, if you have good players, you can usually figure out a way to get them to be used. And if you don't want point guards in your triangle, then stop drafting them. And because they not only drafted two last year, they signed another one in Ramon Sessions. So when you look at a coach that has a style that maybe doesn't fit the personnel, do you think that the coach is either being stubborn or is the coach trying to teach kids that maybe are being stubborn on the other side of this?
I never worry about another guy's style. If that coach is comfortable teaching that style of play, that's fine. If the talent does not match that style of play, you're going to lose, whether it's NBA, college, or even high school. When you have talent that is at the top level of the talent of your league, they will adapt to whatever style you have, and you will invariably win. Because not only because of the talent, but of the combination of philosophy of offense and defense, then they will compensate for one another. When you say that a style didn't win here, or a style didn't win there, it could be because the style is the player level is overrated, or the player level is a style, no matter what the style of play, is not going to be into the playoffs. I don't care what kind of style of play you use with them.
Mm-hmm.
But I just want to say one thing about the triangle. When I was in Milwaukee, we used parts of the triangle. I was back in 73, and they were using it in 71 when Kareem came in the league. Well, at the base of the triangle, you had Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And in the backcourt, you had Oscar Robertson. So they were running a phase of that. But they ran any number. Believe me, they had over 25 sets, okay? And the triangle was just one part of it. Now, when the triangle became so successful in Chicago, you had Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen. Never mind the first time, you had Horace Grant. And then you had Billy Cartwright at the center position. Now, when Michael came back, you had Dennis Rodman playing a power forward instead of Horace Grant, but you still had Pippen and you had Jordan. And I'm not even mentioning, now remember, Cartwright's still a center. Now, we're talking about very talented people.
But different parts.
Yeah, right, correct. Yeah. No, but then you go to L.A. and it's successful again. Why? Because you got Shaq and you got Kobe. So right. Let's just go now and talk. Kurt Rambis is one of, I would say, if you go back, now, since the triangle became successful in Chicago, go back and look up how many young coaches came out of those systems, got jobs, and were let go within a three-year period of time. Because the triangle did not work because of the caliber and style, the caliber level of the players. So to me, the caliber level of the players. I'll give you a good example. Am I talking too long?
No. Trust me. We can do it all day. It's just a podcast.
Okay. See, when we went to Memphis, the team was already 0-8, and we had 2 days to practice. So we did two double sessions. I brought three coaches with me. To me, I had to have a shooting coach because I used to watch their games due to the fact that my son was their advanced scout. And I knew the team, but it was a very poor shooting team. So you got to have an excellent shooting coach. All right, so then we went in and we put in what was good for us in Kentucky, in Atlanta, and in New York stuff. Well, after we played 12 games, we realized that the power game that we ran successfully in all those places could not be run with this talent level. So what we did now is we dropped the power sets. We put in different sets of more quickness, more secondary breaks, three secondary breaks. If we went 2-on-1, 3-on-2, 4-on-3, we didn't get it. We would slide right into one of three secondary breaks that we taught. Two were horizontal and one was vertical. So consequently now, we could still take advantage of the mismatches that we had in the open floor. That was one thing. The next thing is we picked up the tempo, not just on misses, but on makes. We picked up our tempo and we played quicker, but within a framework. And we still ran certain sets, but they were all quick hitting. We became more of a three-point shooting team. And because of this excellent shooting coach, Hal Whistle, he took guys like Shane Battier and Mike Miller and James Posey and made these guys 40%+ three-point shooters. So we had to adjust to the talent base. Now, I guarantee you, if we have 10 guys listening to what I'm talking about, five guys will tell you, you know what, I would do that way also. The other five guys, no, I would take patience, I would teach them better, and I would develop them, and after a few years of experience, they would develop into my system. See, it's not a concrete answer.
Right.
It goes with the personality of the coach and the teaching level of the coaching staff.
Hubie, I just want to tell you how much I appreciate your time. I don't know if you remember, but about 6 years ago, I called you when I was working for the Boston Celtics radio station. And I was just a nervous guy trying to get you on my show, and I mentioned that I'd watched the Bernard King game when you were head coach, and you ended up talking about Bernard King with me for 20 minutes off the air on the phone, and then you came on and did an interview later that week, and it was awesome, and just like this, I expected to be awesome. It was that, and we really appreciate your work, man.
Well, I appreciate that.
I hope a lot of people enjoyed that. I know I did. It's a little bit more detailed in some of the stuff. But right now, we're going to talk to one of the great players, at least the man who had one of the coolest posters of all time, and that's George Gervin. George, I want to start with something. Do you remember the Iceman poster where you had the two silver basketballs you were palming and all the fog behind you?
Oh, yeah. I'm looking at it right now.
Are you really? You don't have any X? My mom made me throw mine away when I moved.
That's what all the guys tell me, man. They say, man, they moved and their mom took it out their room, put it in the garage, or threw it away. Man, ain't that sad.
I still have my Moses one where he has the big staff and the robe, but I don't think that shot in like Israel or anything like that. I think it might have been a studio shot. When you talk about your era, how much of the game was about style as well as understanding how to win?
Well, I mean, you know, especially coming in from the ABA.
Right.
I mean, you know, the ABA, that's all it was style. So, you know, to bring that, you know, particular style into the NBA, you know, I think it just made the league better. You know, I think, you know, being able to put the ball in the basket, our San Antonio Spurs teams, we probably averaged 110, 112 points. you know, I always thought that was fun for the, you know, for the game of basketball. So, you know, I think style plays a role, you know, in the game today.
When you made that switch over, with 76, 77 season, you're 24 years old, you're now in the NBA. What was the biggest challenge for you as a player?
Well, I mean, you know, when I came in, you know, I was playing forward, you know, so, you know, therefore, only about 185 pounds, you know, running up against them guys that's, you know, 230, 240, and 250, you know, and, you know, at the forward spot, you know, that was, you know, kind of tough on me physically. But, you know, once I moved up to the two guard, you know, the game really got easy for me because, you know, you really didn't have that many tall two guards, and it just really gave me a big advantage.
When you watch the game today, how different is it from perhaps the way you thought it would be going back 25, 30 years ago?
Well, I don't think the game is really any different. I mean, you know, obviously some of the rules have changed. You know, when we played, you know, you could body up more. You know, you could put your hands on the guy and kind of stop him from forward progress, you know, so the game was probably a little bit more physical, you know, in the sense of, you know, being able to, you know, touch guys, you know, but, you know, in today's game, you know, if you put your hand on them, I mean, it's a foul. So I think that's a big difference. So the guys should be able to score a lot easier, you know, because they don't really have them hands on them or them elbows on their sides.
How many would you get a game now then, if you were saying 27, 26-year-old George Gervin, today's game?
Oh, wow. You know, I mean, I know I averaged 30-something.
Right, because you know, did that a couple years.
Easily.
So you think you'd score more now because of the rules?
Oh, ain't no question. I mean, you know, and the simple fact is because guys was able to put their hands on you and stop your forward progress. I mean, so therefore, you know, I would get more free throws. I mean, I shot 87%, you know, career. So, you know, I mean, I'd be able to shoot more wide open jumpers. I mean, you know, because of no hand check. So, yeah, I mean, I feel that it'll be a lot easier for me.
What if a guy, though, say in the late 70s was built like LeBron and walked into the gym to play with you guys? What would you do? How would you look at each other?
Oh, man, it'd be kind of scary. I mean, you know, LeBron phenom, man. You know, you don't really get guys coming in, you know, what, he's 6'8", what, he 250?
Yeah, more than that, you know, probably.
I mean, run like a reindeer, you know, jump like a gazelle. I mean, he's incredible. He's an incredible specimen. I mean, and, you know, you just don't run into guys, you know, like a LeBron James, very often.
George, when we look at your legacy, and I don't know if this makes any sense, but the way you talk, the way you've been portrayed in some of the ads, you've remained cool. And I hate to make it sound so simple, but you what, be 58 this month? Is that right?
Oh, hey, you better believe that.
How have you been able to remain, you know, one of those guys that everybody still embraces and, man, they think, it's George Gervin. That guy's still cool.
Well, I mean, I've always been a humble guy. You know, I always appreciate the opportunities that, you know, that was, you know, given to me. You know, I love the game of basketball. I really worked hard at it. And, you know, that was just my style. I mean, yeah, it ain't my fault because ice is cool.
I don't think anybody's ever asked you to apologize for it.
No.
it's just one of those things. Whenever, you know, when they were running those Nike ads a few years back, it was like a whole new generation got to learn about you and your style, and, you know, younger guys start asking you, like, what's up with this guy? What's this guy's deal? And then they're like, man, George Gervin. They just shake their head, and it's always in a complimentary style.
Well, you know, and that's something you appreciate, you know. I mean, you know, I always appreciate people, you know, I always appreciate, you know, the competition, when I played, and, you know, I love the game, man. So, you know, I played the game with all my heart. So, you know, my style was just a part of how I played.
Well, Kevin Durant went off last night, a ton of points in a tough loss in overtime against Utah, but you have a connection with him. What is that relationship?
Well, you know, the NBA started a mentoring program a few years ago, and they assigned me to Kevin Durant and Jeff Green. You know, so, you know, I get a chance to, you know, talk to Kevin, talk to Jeff, you know, talk about basketball, you know, talk about community service, you know, talk about, you know, them guys, you know, really getting involved in the community. And these guys are our future, you know, of the NBA. So, you know, it's a special situation for me and, you know, hopefully for them guys, you know, to have a veteran of the league, to be a part of, you know, their basketball and you know, and their life.
What if I was to tell you my co-host at 6'7", Scott Van Pelt, can finger roll?
You know, one thing he could do is finger roll. I like to see that.
Yeah, I think he would like to see it too at some point. I don't know if he has that in his game. George, thanks so much for your time today, man.
Hey, guys, thank you.
Good stuff today from the guys. Coming up on Friday, as we mentioned, Larry Kuhn, the NBA salary cap expert. We'll get you ready for the weekend. Until then, don't ever ask, do you think one of these girls from UConn could play in the NBA?
Thank you for listening to the NBA Today. Download more ESPN podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or on the PodCenter page at ESPNRadio.com.